A very good morning to everyone. The court will hear argument first in case number 073406, Five Points Road against Mike Johans. Mr. Keppel.
May it please the court, I'm John Keppel from the Appellate Staff, Civil Division, U.S. Department of Justice, and I'm representing the appellants, the Secretary of Agriculture, and other officials who have been sued in this action. The issue before the court on this appeal is whether appeal proceedings before the National Appeals Division of the U.S. Department of Agriculture are conducted on the record under Section 554 of the APA and therefore constitute adversary adjudications under the administrative prong of the Equal Access to Justice Act. The Supreme Court's decisions in Ardestani and Marcello, as well as a review of, as well as the statutory text and structure, the legislative history, the sovereign immunity principles, general statutory construction principles, and case law from both this court, other circuits, and the Supreme Court, establish beyond peradventure that these proceedings are not under Section 554, and therefore EJIA does not apply.
Well, I'm not sure it established it to that degree of certainty, in as much as two other circuits have come to the opposite conclusion on this precise issue and have distinguished those two Supreme Court cases, Ardestani and Marcello. And so you're basically asking us to create a circuit split on the precise issue that's before us.
Yes, Your Honor, we are, and with all due respect, we believe that the Eighth Circuit in Lane and the Ninth Circuit, which followed the Lane decision in Agassiz, simply got it wrong, and therefore the district court erred in following those decisions, and we urge this court not to fall into the same error. We've set forth at considerable length in our briefs the reasons as to why the Eighth and Ninth Circuits got this issue wrong, but there are a number of telling indications. For instance, the Lane decision did not even mention the doctrine of sovereign immunity at all, and the Agassiz decision relied on Lane, and while it did mention sovereign immunity, it said that it relied on inapposite language from Agassiz, from Ardestani, to the effect that courts shouldn't cut back on existing waivers of sovereign immunity. Of course, here we are dealing with a partial waiver of sovereign immunity, and that is by definition the very situation in which the doctrine of strict construction of waivers of sovereign immunity comes into play. These are some illustrative examples. The Agassiz court also made a significant error when it relied on the Portland Audubon Society and on the Lane court's notion simply because a hearing is on the record, or simply because a matter is adjudicated on the record after the opportunity for a hearing, Section 554 is satisfied. That is entirely inconsistent with the rationale of Ardestani. And Ardestani even said, and I quote, it's at the bottom of page 134 of Ardestani, Ardestani's principal argument is that for purposes of the EJIA, deportation proceedings fall under Section 554 because, like the adjudications described in Section 554A, they are, quote, required by statute to be determined on the record after opportunity for an agency hearing, end quote. We hold that the meaning of an adjudication under Section 554 is unambiguous in the context of the EJIA and does not permit the reading that Ardestani has urged upon us. So, the Lane and Agassiz decisions are in the teeth of the Supreme Court's holding in Ardestani and are entirely inconsistent with the reasoning of that decision. Ardestani, of course, in turn relied on the Supreme Court's decision in Marcello versus Fons, where the Supreme Court held that deportation scheme under the Immigration and Nationality Act constituted a separate and freestanding scheme that was not under Section 554 of the APA. And there, too, the plaintiffs here mistakenly believe that the that Artistani or that Marcello relied chiefly upon the fact that there was that the INA contained an exclusivity provision. But when you read the Marcello decision, it is clear that that was simply one factor, and indeed it was the last factor that the court relied on. The court really relied on the fact that the INA was a laborious adaptation of the APA to the particular circumstances of the deportation area, and that it contained significant deviations from the APA. Then it also mentioned the exclusivity provision at the end of that sentence. But that is analogous to the situation that we have here, where the NAD statute is a laborious adaptation of the APA to the proceedings.
A laborious adaptation. And reading the briefs, I went back, read the case, read the language, read the use of that language in the case. I guess I didn't see where it was such a laborious adaptation.
Well, Your Honor, the legislative history shows that it was, because the Senate bill, would have simply made these proceedings under the APA. It would have incorporated the APA. The House bill would have left the matter to the Secretary just to establish procedures. And what Congress wound up enacting was really a hybrid that bore more of a resemblance to the House bill, but that actually set forth numerous procedures, specific procedures, that fully substitute for the APA.
Which brings me to my next question as to whether there is any legislative history of that conference committee and the reasons why the conference committee came up with the version of the statute that it did.
Your Honor, to my knowledge, there isn't. I mean, if there had been illuminating legislative history on that score, we certainly would have included it in the briefs. We've attempted to set forth a full recitation of the legislative history in the briefs.
That's appreciated.
Thank you.
You also mentioned in your brief that Congressional Budget Office had omitted from its budget estimates the NAD process, funding for a EAJA. How much weight should we really put on that? I mean, that seems to be terribly attenuated in terms of trying to divine legislative intent here.
Well, Your Honor, given that the Congressional Budget Office estimated that there would be 13,000 of these proceedings a year, I would respectfully disagree with the characterization that it's attenuated, because obviously something like that would, if Congress contemplated making EJIA applicable to a system that involves 13,000 appeals a year, that would lead to numerous EJIA claims and to significant EJIA awards. And there's no indication that the Congressional Budget Office thought that was Congress's intent. So that also supports the Secretary's position here. Another factor that supports the Secretary's position is that Congress did, in 7 U.S.C. 6999, specifically incorporate Section 7 of the APA, 5 U.S.C. 701, et cetera, which is the judicial review provision of the APA. So it's clear that Congress did that in that context, but it's equally clear that Congress didn't do it in the administrative context. And all that Congress did was incorporate the definition of ex parte proceedings, of ex parte communications, from the Section 551 of the APA, not even Section 554. So there's simply it is too great a leap on the basis of that to say that Congress made these proceedings under Section 554 of the APA.
You rely in your brief, if I may shift the focus just a wee bit here, on the Friends of the Earth case. But it seemed to me that was a very different kind of a hearing. I mean, didn't the court specifically note there that, I mean, this was a withdrawal proceeding, which was what was at stake in the Friends of the Earth case. It really it was prone to involve legal issues, deciding whether or not our state program was the equivalent of the federal RCRA and what have you. Is that really the same kind of issue that we have here before us in these agricultural cases?
Well, Your Honor, it's the same type of general analysis, and of course it followed the lead decision in the D.C. Circuit, the St. Louis Fuel decision, written by then Judge, now Justice Ginsburg. And that is even more critical than Friends of the Earth, because there just then Judge Ginsburg even said that to be under to be subject to EJA, Congress must have, and she used the word required, full compliance with all Section 554 procedures, and that
she had far more explicit legislative history than we have to deal with there.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that there was more legislative history, but here the legislative history is more by implication from Congress's deliberate decision not to adopt the Senate version, which would have explicitly made these proceedings under Section 554. And this Court's decisions in Smedberg, City of West Chicago, and the Peabody Coal case also support the Secretary's position here, because in Smedberg, which was involved labor certifications, this Court reiterated the principle that EJA is a waiver of sovereign immunity that has to be strictly construed, and it held that the labor certification proceedings in that case were not under Section 554. Similarly, in the City of West Chicago case, the court found that the nuclear proceedings, the atomic materials licensing proceedings in that case, were not under Section 554, and that it said that there were no magic words that made something under Section 554. What was required was a determination of congressional intent based on the statute. And in the Peabody Coal case, this court said in order to craft an exemption from the APA, from Section 554, the court need not use talismanic phrases, but again, this was a matter of congressional intent. So just as there are no magic words to put something under Section 554, there are no magical passwords as the Supreme Court stated in Marcello, that take it out from under Section 554. And therefore, we respectfully urge the court to reverse the decision of the district court here.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. We'll hear now from Mr. Brown.
Good morning, Your Honors. Excuse me, I'm a little nervous. us lawyers out in DeKalb County don't get a chance to argue cases in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals very often. In the 32 years of practice, this is my first and probably my last time. So I'm very honored to be here this morning representing my clients to argue this case before you. My clients, typical father, son-in-law, farming operation, livestock and grain farmers out in DeKalb County. And I won't go into the facts, but they had a little disagreement with the Farm Service Agency over their participation in the farm program. We went through the administrative appeals process, were affirmed all the way up, and then filed this request for attorney's fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. And as you know, the USDA has taken the position that the EAJA does not apply to National Appeals Division hearings. The USDA, essentially, in this case, is trying to rewrite a long, long precedent of law that has been established in terms of how we determine whether or not an administrative proceeding is governed by Section 554 of the APA. Justice Rehnquist, in 1972, in the U.S. versus Allegheny Ludden Steel Corporation case, once said that we don't need any specific words for the Section 554 on the record hearing to be applicable to an agency hearing. All we have to know is that it is a hearing that is required to be on the record after an opportunity for a hearing for the administrative agency. And this court has also followed that same line of precedent in City of Chicago, West Chicago versus U.S. Nuclear Regulatory, and then Smedberg, Machine and Tool versus Donovan, both cases we've cited, have all said, again, that you don't have to make specific reference to Section 554 for that section to govern an agency proceeding. Yet what the USDA would like to do is to add now a new dimension, that is, for the EAJ to be applicable to hearings under Section 554, the statute now needs to say that that proceeding is conducted under Section 554 of the APA.
I think if we were to accept the Department of Justice's view, it would emaciate the APA far and beyond its applicability to your particular case.
Absolutely. And would unravel many, many statutory provisions that are already on the books that the USDA even acknowledges requires that the EAJ apply. In our brief, we cited to the court over 50 statutes governed by the Department of Agriculture in which the USDA already acknowledges that those hearings are subject to EAJA. I've read every one of those statutes that spells out what type of hearing and when it must be conducted. Only 3 out of all 50 of those statutes make any reference to the APA. And yet the Department of Justice and the USDA acknowledges, they've adopted regulations for how you are to apply for an EAJA award if you are a participant under one of those statutory proceedings. Nowhere in their brief have they explained to the court why those 50 statutory sections that are administered by the United States Department of Agriculture are any different than the appeal process that governs these farm programs that are governed by the National Appeals Division. What is the reasoning for there to be a difference between those statutory provisions and these proceedings? Also, interestingly enough, the Secretary of Agriculture in the 1994 Farm Bill that adopted the or created the National Appeals Division authorized the Secretary of Agriculture to make any one of those other proceedings subject to NAD. So if we're talking about partial waiver of sovereign immunity, what you have here is a situation where we all know only Congress can waive sovereign immunity. Are we to assume that Congress delegated to the Secretary of Agriculture the ability to revoke the partial waiver by designating other proceedings under to be governed by NAD? Because essentially that's what the Department of Justice is saying, is that any proceeding under NAD is not subject to the EAJA. And yet Congress gave the Secretary of Agriculture the ability to add other types of proceedings that are currently administered outside of NAD to be governed by NAD. So essentially that gave the Secretary of Agriculture, if you believe their position, the power to revoke sovereign immunity, waiver of sovereign immunity.
Could you comment on the distinction counsel tried to draw with respect to the Eighth Circuit and Ninth Circuit case and our situation?
Well, honestly, I don't think there can be a distinction drawn. They are just two cases totally on point on all fours. I guess as an appellate lawyer, you can't have a better situation to come before on the third time. They have two other appellate decisions that basically rule completely on your favor. You know, they really have to get to where they want to go in this case, they have to build this case around the Marcello decision and then bootstrap the Argostani decision to that. Because really, they have no other basis to argue that this statutory mandated appellate process is not a proceeding that's on the record after an opportunity for a hearing. And Marcello, yeah, it's out there, but it really is an isolated case. You don't see a long line of cases where the Supreme Court has followed the Marcello opinion in terms of deciding whether or not the APA governs a particular type of proceeding or not. You know, Marcello really was an isolated case that had a tremendously different legislative history. You know, in that case, as you'll recall, you know, first the court ruled that immigration proceedings were governed by APA. Then Congress enacted the Immigration Act and said, no, we're going to not make these proceedings subject to the APA. Well, that's what the court had before it when it next considered whether or not they had revoked that consideration. We don't have that sort of legislative history in this case that suggests that Congress intended not to have these proceedings governed by the EAJA. In fact, it kind of goes back to the point Justice Ripple was making about the what's the importance of the whether the Budget Office considered the cost of the EAJA as applied to these proceedings. The reason I bring that up, and I cite two law reviews in my brief, is that to understand what Congress was attempting to do when they adopted the NAD, at the time, the USDA was really kind of totally a bureaucratic department, and the treatment that was afforded to the farmers that were involved in their programs was unfair. Both of those articles point out what some of the irregularities were that were being followed at the time that they adopted the NAD. And so when Congress passed this bill, what they were trying to do was level the playing field for all program participants and others who use services from the USDA. It would be ironic to assume that when they're trying to make this a fairer system, that we would have a budget office that would have to anticipate that the government wasn't going to really follow their own attempt to make this a fairer system. Because you have to remember, EAJA only applies when the government acts without substantial justification. So here we have a major piece of legislation intended to make, I think as Secretary Espy said, a farmer-friendly, taxpayer-friendly governmental process, and yet we're going to have to anticipate that the government's not going to abide by the new rules, and that we have to anticipate that there's some percentage of the cases they're going to still continue to act without substantial justification. I found that quite ironic that that would have been an argument in favor of the Congress's intent to not make the EAJA applicable to these proceedings. It doesn't, for those who may not live and work out in the rural community, for the past 30 years, the farm program has been the economic lifeline for the agricultural community. Farmers have had to depend on their eligibility and participation in the farm programs in order to eke out an economic existence out there. I have represented, of course, many farmers in dealing with the local agency offices. And I can tell you the fear that has instilled in farm families if they don't dot their I's and cross their T's exactly right. Because if they are denied the ability to participate in the farm program, they are essentially out of farming. That's the way it's been for the past 30 years. Maybe things are changing a little bit, but I can tell you for the last 30 years, you had to be able to participate in the farm program if you were going to stay in farming. So it strikes me as very odd that Congress would have wanted to deny farm families and others who participate in the farm program the opportunity when they were unjustly charged with some program violation, the opportunity to ask the court to have their attorney's fees and costs reimbursed. So I would ask the court to affirm the district court's decision and to really make this a uniform process for all farm program participants across this country. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. How much time does Mr. Copel have? Thank you. Mr. Copel, maybe you could begin by speaking to the point raised by your colleague as to what the impact of this of a holding, as you have suggested we may give it, would be to the general viability of the APA. It sounds like you're asking us to to carve a fairly large exception.
Your Honor, with all due respect, it's not a large exception, but an extremely narrow one. USDA has recognized in 7 CFR section 1.183 that there is a multitude of statutes clearly are on the record and are subject to section 554. USDA will not be in any way empowered by this decision to change that fact and to go back and conclude that those proceedings are not under section 554 of the APA. That's simply a red herring. Nor is USDA trying to carve out any kind of major exception to the analysis of how a court would determine whether something is under section 554. Certainly, if the court, USDA recognizes that Congress does not have to use magic words, that it can say that something is under section 554, it can specify it, or if there is silence, as there is in many statutes, that can also lead to the conclusion that the congressional intent was to put it under section 554, and that is true in most cases. It is only in this type of situation, and this is the only one that we are aware of, the NAD statute, where Congress has done the same sort of thing that it did in Marcello and laboriously adapted section 554 procedures to the specific NAD context, that this comes into play. So this would be a very limited exception to the general rule that agency proceedings are under section 554. So if there are no further questions, also, I thought that it was curious that opposing counsel suggested that Marcello was some kind of outlier, when the crucial fact, of course, is that the Supreme Court followed the reasoning of Marcello in Ardestani, which is the lead case, the only Supreme Court case construing administrative EJA. So that clearly, by its term, both Marcello and Ardestani are the most important cases in this area, and we respectfully urge this court to follow them and not to perpetuate the error of the Eighth and Ninth Circuits. If there are no further questions, I thank the court.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. Indeed, the court would like to thank both counsel for their very excellent briefs in this case and for their fine oral arguments today. And the case will be taken under advisement.